I don't think that we've ever had somebody like this on the podcast. One of just about a dozen people who have scored 70 goals in one season in the National Hockey League. One of even fewer who had 150 points in a season. He put up an 8-point game. And oh yeah, just recently, his number 16 was raised to the rafters at the Leon Center in Kingston. Mr. Bernie Nichols joins the OHL podcast. Is that enough? I mean, I think there's so much more I could put in there, Bernie.
Oh, I think that hit pretty much everything, but that's good.
Okay, well, let's start with the most recent and that honor in Kingston when they raise your number 16 to the rafters. What was the experience like for you?
You know, it was really cool, obviously. Honored. They told me last year, I went and did a book signing there last year, and they told me they wanted to do it. And, you know, obviously when they told you, you're all excited. But then once it gets close and it really happens, it was really special. So, like I said, I was honored for that.
I'm sure it's an opportunity for you to pause and think back on those early days, those seasons you did spend in Kingston. What stands out to you?
You know, the friendships you made. I took my billet that night. He was on the ice with me and Amanda. It was, you know, I think it gets overlooked, you know, by people, the importance that they really are to you. My cousin just told me the other day he was doing something with his billet from like the 70s or something like that when he left home. We leave home at such a young age, right? I was 16 when I left home, and I think it's so important to be put in with a good family. And so for me to have Vern up there that night to be there with me, I thought was he really enjoyed it, and I just thought it was a special moment for him as well.
Where does it rank with being inducted into the Haliburton Highlands Sports Hall of Fame?
Yeah, it's similar, right? Anytime you're inducted into anything, it's obviously special. And looking back, when they went through all the accolades there, still, when I scored 63 goals in 65 games, you know, I thought I didn't even really think about it until, because I always knew we played 68 games, or the juniors played 68 games. And then to have the record for most points still, that's pretty special, right, to do that. I know I have one in L.A. that will hopefully never be broke, the 70 goals. So I just thought that number was pretty good to still have that today.
I have a feeling that one won't be broken either. 63 goals, 152 points in one Ontario Hockey League season. The one number that did get knocked over by a kid by the name of Shane Wright just a couple of years ago was the rookie goal record at 36. Did you talk to Shane Wright at all afterwards?
I did. And that was in my speech the other night, right? And it's funny because I always say to people that, and I just actually did a event last weekend with Daryl Sittler, who has 10 points in one game, right? And like everybody, he obviously wants that record to go forever. And I always say to people that say, you know, records are made to be broken, that's because they don't have any. No one wants their record ever to be broken, no matter what it is. And, you know, Shane, and the funny thing is with Shane, he was like 15 years old or something, right? But I obviously reached out to him and congratulated him. There's a big difference between being 18 and 15 to get that record. So I reached out to him and congratulated him for sure.
It's so funny, Bernie, you mentioned that event with Daryl Sittler, and the first thing that comes into my mind is that 10-point game he had. And I already mentioned that you are the owner of an 8-point game in the National Hockey League, which just blows my mind. But then when you're together with Daryl, does he chirp you? Come on, Bernie. What, you couldn't get two more points?
Yeah, you know what? He was talking about that the other night, about, you know, the whole day as far as that goes, right? Like his day, something happened at the rink, because hockey players, we're programmed, we do the same thing every day. Gretz brought that up in one of his in one of the podcasts or one of the interviews he did, that every day he has either steak and potatoes pregame, and every athlete's the same, right? You do the same routine every day. And this day with Daryl, he something happened that he was late leaving the rink or this, that. So he just pulled over the side of the road and went to got Chalet chicken, Swiss Chalet chicken. And they end up, you know, and he gets 10 points and they end up sending him like $500 gift certificate for chicken for, you know, and he said that buys a lot of chicken. But he said that, you know, even Gretzky and I've been with Wayne, like Wayne had 8 points after two periods one night. And like any athlete that they gun for something like that. And I don't think that'll ever be broken either. There's a few of us that have had eight. No one's, I think, said nine. Daryl's had 10. And like I said, Gretz had 8 points after two periods a couple times and couldn't get to 10.
The night you got eight, was anything different in your day?
No, it was just a normal day. You know, had my pregame. Everything went the same. But you know, we only had nine goals, and to think be a part of eight of it. Like there was different times I could have had more goals. You know, as many as you get in on eight, I very easily could have been in on 10 or 11 because I had that many more chances. Just didn't go in.
You mentioned that 63-goal, 152-point season in Kingston, which still stands as a single-season record. And that was your second and final year there in Kingston. But you guys, Bernie, oh, did you have a team that year with the Kingston Canadians? And some way, somehow, those darn Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds got you in the Leyden Division final.
Yeah, and you know what? And you see that a lot in the NHL. Last year, if you remember Florida, right? Florida had such a they actually won the President's Cup, I think, the year before, but they came into it where everybody was healthy, their goalie was healthy, and they just got on a roll. If you remember the Kings in 2012, I was fortunate enough to be with them. We just squeaked in the last game or two to get in the playoffs. The goalie got hot and they just rolled. And that's what happened. Donnie Beaupre was the goalie. They just peaked at the right time. On paper, they had no chance to beat us, but the problem is they don't play the game on paper. They had to play it, and their team just gelled at the right time, and they got great goaltending, and they just, you know, they beat us. So they're obviously very disappointing because we had I think three first round defensemen. Our goalie was first round to Boston, Mike Moffitt, and we definitely shouldn't have lost that, but team got hot at the right time.
You were drafted by the France, that's who they are now, the Canadians, in the seventh round. And you know, looking back on your career and everything you've done, Bernie, it kind of boggles my mind. It defies imagination that the coach, Jimmy Morrison, didn't even keep you up with the team in your first year. He sent you back down.
Yeah, I had that happen, and same in L.A. First year, they sent me to the minors, and there it was kind of, they drafted a first-round draft choice, and he was on a one-way contract. My dad talked to Jimmy Morrison, and, you know, he kept Justin Hanley, and Jimmy, and my dad said to Jimmy, you're making a big mistake, and, you know, whether it's because the other kid was a higher draft choice or whatever, you know, looking back, you talk to Jimmy now, he's going to tell you, yeah, I made a mistake. LA's going to tell you they made a mistake. And for whatever reason, it happened. But, you know, it didn't discourage me. I went down and played well, no matter, you know, whether it was in Kingston or in LA, and came back up and did what I do best and, you know, proved the coaches and the managers wrong on both sides. And, you know, it's frustrating that you do get sent down when you know you shouldn't. But you can either whine and complain about it, or you can go out and do something about it.
You know, you talk about proving those coaches wrong, and that's exactly what I was wondering. It happens to you in Kingston, happens to you in LA. Did you feel, despite what you had accomplished in your career, despite your obvious skill on the ice, that you always had something to prove, Bernie?
No, not really. As a player, you know what you're capable of doing. I've never ever had a confidence problem with myself. You're upset that maybe the other people don't see it and you have to go. But like I say, with LA, it was just a matter of the guy that were ahead of me, were on one-way contracts. So, you know, which shouldn't matter there, but it does, and it did early. Here in Kingston, whether it was just a numbers game and they didn't know, you're thinking it's a seventh round draft choice. Even though when I get drafted, I was the rookie of the year in Woodstock. So they do know what you have, but maybe they didn't quite know what they had. So to go ahead and send them down, and they did call me up for the playoffs. And then obviously the next year was, you know, from then on, it, you know, you proved them wrong. But I've never had any confidence issues myself. You just get frustrated when other people maybe don't see it at first. So you just go prove them wrong, I guess.
At Leon Center, where they hung your number 16, it's a pretty nice arena compared. I'm nothing to take away from the old barn in Kingston, but boy, oh boy, have they upgraded, eh?
Yeah, they have. And you know, the thing for me was the memorial was, it was kind of like a NHL size rink, the sheet. Like I know they all are now, but back in, you know, the 70s and that, they all weren't big arenas like that. So playing on the NHL size ice pad at the time was great. That was a nice arena to play in for a skilled player because it was big. Now they're all the same, but I really enjoyed my time at that arena.
At what point in your time did you decide, or did you add the full length fur coat to your wardrobe?
Well, you know, and that came up the other day too. I think when you get hit in the head as many times as I did playing, you forget a lot. And so Vern owned a fur store, and I worked there, and I guess my roommate and I, Phil Bork, we modeled for Vern those coats, and I end up buying that full length wolf coat from him. And I say to people, I should have maybe waited till I get drafted first. I maybe jumped the gun a little bit because not knowing you're getting drafted to LA, I probably didn't need it. But I actually still have, because a couple years into pro, I bought another full length otter coat from Vern, and I still have it to this day.
That's incredible and good point. I mean, you would have maybe wanted a surfboard and some sandals based on where you got drafted, eh?
That's right. Yeah.
You know, another little tidbit I came across that kind of blew my mind a little bit was a story from David Branch, still until the end of this year, the commissioner in the Ontario Hockey League. And he talked about a young Bernie Nichols coming over to his cottage, which was kind of a neighboring cottage to yours when you were a kid, kind of knocking on the door because you knew he had some hockey posters of some kind.
And I don't know how it came about, but my dad knew that David lived there. David lived in the lake next to ours. I'm on pine, David was on grass, and so we went and visited him. And maybe it was after I was a junior player, so I got to know him a little bit. But my dad introduced me to him. He found out somehow, and a nice relationship formed from that.
It was almost meant to be, Bernie. You're that close to the commissioner. You end up in the league playing in Kingston. I mean, these things were just destined, I think, for you.
Yeah, it worked out great. And that's, you know, that's probably the best thing about playing the NHL too, right? People always ask, what's the greatest thing about this and that? And it's the people you meet, the friendships that you know, you form. And a lot of it's with teammates and stuff, right? Like, but it's other people too, like David and other people around the league.
When you arrived in LA, I mean, you get there to a Kings team with Marcel Dion and Dave Taylor and Charlie Simmer and so many more. Were you in awe at all?
Well, I think the cool part about getting drafted, right? And I don't know if you remember Ryan Watson. Ryan played in Washington. He was a tough guy, but little. He was my size, but he was tough. And so I taught at a hockey school with Brian and Walt McKechnie. And one thing about when you get drafted, right? Especially back then. I think it's so much different now because I think it's so important that the older guys kind of take the younger guys under their wing and, you know, help them out. And it wasn't so much that back in the early 80s, I guess. And Brian Bugsy Watson, he said, look, he's because I knew when I was going there, they had Marcel Dion, which I wasn't taking Marcel's job. But when you get drafted to a team, you're going to have to go take someone's job, right? That's what sucks about our sport is you're coming in and you're taking someone's job. And Brian kind of told me there was like three other centermen there. He knew, but he knew what I had and he knew their talent there. And he said, you're just going to go take it. So he kind of prepared me for that. But looking back, you know, guys like Dave Taylor and Charlie Simmer and Mars and Mike Murphy were kind of the older guys that they knew me coming in was going to help them. So they kind of took me under their wing. The centermen that I was coming to take their job, they're not real friendly, right? When someone's coming to take their job, you don't get much support from them, which I never did. But I knew going in, it wasn't going to be a problem me taking their job anyways.
You certainly endeared yourself to the home fans in your rookie season. Three straight home games, you put up a hat trick. I mean, for some guys, that's a rookie season. You had nine in three different home games.
Three in a row, yeah. I think it was my ninth game. I scored two goals in Colorado. We won 2-0, and you know, it's like anything. It's as a skilled player, right? It's once you get that first one, then it kind of comes. And I was fortunate, and I don't know if it's been done before, like three straight home games. So obviously, I kind of got their attention then because I was just nicely called up. And then they realized that I was going to help their team, and I think the players it showed the players that they knew what they had to as a teammate, right? So the fans loved it. Obviously, I loved it. So I got off to a pretty good start with the fans in LA.
You know, you kind of read my mind when you talked about your teammates knowing what kind of teammate they now had in Bernie Nichols, and they took to calling you by the nickname Franchise. Even like Charlie Simmer in a practice would bow down to the franchise. What's going through a young hockey player's head when he's hearing stuff like that?
Well, you don't hate it. Obviously, they show a lot of confidence in you, and they know what they got as far as your ability to help the team. So I think anytime they give you something like that, other than, you know, you never compare a player to like a Gretzky or Lemieux or something like that. That's a bad thing to be tagged with. But something like that that can help the franchise. Help the team. There's nothing wrong with that.
There were a couple of guys that would be, I think, described as the franchises for their particular team, the New York Islanders, and Mike Bossy and Brian Trottier. Did you really ask those guys for sticks after you knocked them out of the playoffs one year?
It was worse than that. I've never played them in the playoffs other than with New York, but Brian was gone by then. They were always my favorite team when I was in junior, when they were on their roll in the early 80s. And I become real good friends with Brian Trottier, the late Clark Gillies. But what I did is after our morning skate, I waited around and I went and got them to sign my stick, every player. But what I didn't remember is, and what Brian tells me, what Clarkie told me is, I went right in their friggin' dressing room and went around like a little kid, asked them to sign my stick. So, kind of embarrassed now to think about that I did that. I was kind of hoping I just gave it to the trainer, but they told me whether they were just, you know, lying to me. But they said I went right in the dressing room and got them to sign my stick and then played against them 7 hours later. So, if I did that, then so be it, I guess. But I
There's
still
no,
have their stick with
do
all
you
their
really?
signatures on it. Yeah, it's an old Victoria stick, a brand new one. They signed it. I still have it.
That is
Can't
a
really read any of the names anymore, but I still have it.
I don't blame you. I mean, that's a fantastic piece of hockey memorabilia for sure.
Yeah. To think how I got it's even worse, but yeah.
So we talked about those legendary Kings names that were in LA when you arrived there, Bernie. And clearly you were a piece of the future. I mean, maybe when they were calling you the franchise, they knew what was to come because you were still there when a guy named Wayne Gretzky was acquired from the Edmonton Oilers. What were the Gretzky days like?
Well, I say to everybody, I don't know what it would be like to play with Wayne for 4 or 5 years, 10 years, right? Like, I got Wayne for a year and a half. I get traded halfway through my second year, but it was amazing. I got to hang with Wayne every day. I tell people, I don't know why, but I was Wayne's guy. Every day we'd go to lunch. Every road trip, we would go out. He'd take me out to dinner. Just Wayne and I. Like, it was unbelievable. And like, I don't know why, but thrilled to death that he picked me. So I got to hang with him every day for a year and a half. So it was pretty cool.
How difficult based on that? I mean, you saw some great offensive success, obviously. The team is making a statement with a deal like that. How difficult was it for you to really accept that trade to New York that came after?
Yeah, they always say your first trade's the hardest, right? That's when you realize that it's a business, and it sucked because I just bought a house in LA, but I asked the owner, I'm not a business person. I said, what do you think? I just signed a new deal there, that he signed me to himself, and he said, I'll never trade you, right? So I bought this house, and 3 months later, you get traded. And I understand why, just because they needed someone for Wayne to play with. Wayne and I are both centermen. They needed wingers for him to play with. He, for some reason, Dave Taylor and Luke Robitaille just didn't gel with Wayne, which was great for me because I got them that year to play with. But they needed someone for Wayne to play with, and so they had to make a deal, and I was the only one that New York would take. But like I said, I don't know what it would be like to play with Wayne for another 4 or 5 years. It would have been obviously very special. So you're hurt, you're devastated when you get traded, and that was why, just more or less because I couldn't play with Wayne anymore.
You say that they tell you the first trade is the hardest, and the next trade that came after that sent you to Edmonton, and that's a chance to do something you hadn't done professionally yet, and that was play for a team in Canada. How did that feel?
Well, I tell everybody, as a Canadian boy, you have to play in Canada somewhere. And for me, it was Edmonton, and it was the best. I had more fun there. Once again, who do I get traded for? It's Mark Messier. And I've said to people, when people ask who's my fiercest competitor that I've ever played against, it was Mark. We're both centermen, so I'd have to face off against him. He was big and strong. Just mean, but so good, right? And I had some great rivalries with Mark, Edmonton, LA. Hell, I got him in New York when I was with the Devils, played against him with when he was with the Rangers. And but going to Edmonton, it was unbelievable. We went to semifinals that year. Who did we meet the first year or the first round? Is the Kings with Gretzky, Curry. I don't know if Coff was there. Charlie Hody was there. Maybe Grant Fuhr. They had half the old Oiler team, and now we go in there and we put them out first round. So that was kind of extra special too. But playing Edmonton was amazing.
It really is. I mean, one of the premier hockey cities. Look, I'm a Leafs fan. I grew up in Southern Ontario, but you got to give it to City of Champions in Edmonton. They love their hockey team.
Yeah, they do. And being a smaller city, I think they you can't compete with Toronto, right? You can't compete with Toronto, Montreal. Toronto fans, they travel so good. But being a small town, small market city as Edmonton, boy, they hold their own with anybody.
You talked about Messier, and being the fiercest competitor you ever played against, and were traded from New York so that he could go there. You meet him later. That semifinal where you met him when you're with the New Jersey Devils, that was the Rangers Cup year. That was the famous Mark Messier guaranteed win year. I mean, when you heard that, did you feel insulted on the other side?
Yeah, no. We knew what Mark was doing. All Mark was saying is, he was just trying to give some confidence to his player, because that's not who Mark is. If anybody knows Mark, he's arguably the best leader there is in sports. He was just trying to tell his team, we can win, guys. I tell people this day, even though the first series with Gretz, we played the Oilers. We were down 3-1, come back in game 7 and beat them to eliminate Edmonton in Wayne's first year. Game 7, I had 2 goals, 2 assists in that final game. But I still say the best series I was ever involved in was New York and the Devils, even though we lost it. 7 games, 3 went into overtime, and game 7 in the double overtime. And we should never have lost that. Right, like we should have actually won game 6 at home, but that's hockey, and we got them 2-0 late in the second period, and we had a giveaway by a rookie, and just when they scored that, but that series was kind of special one to be involved in.
You were involved in 118 playoff games overall, 114 points in those 118 games. So, point of game pace, even in the playoffs. What was it about the postseason that you enjoyed so much?
That's why you play the game, right? Is to get in playoffs and have a playoff run, and there's nothing better. Like it's so hard to explain. Like, 'cause like most athletes, you're just so competitive, and when there's so much on the line, and the playoffs are just so much fun to play. As much as a regular season game, there's something special about the playoffs, and you want to be a part of it, and you want to help your team however you can. And to me, there was just nothing better than the playoffs.
Might have been the closest you came as a player when the Rangers knock you out, but you did get the chance to win a Stanley Cup as you were a coaching consultant with the Kings when they won one of theirs. How did that come about?
Well, I was fortunate to play for Darryl Sutter. Played with him in Chicago. I played with him in San Jose. And that year, early in the year, just as an alumni from the Kings, I love watching the Kings play, and their power play just absolutely sucked. They'd lose games, with 4 or 5 power plays and 5-on-3s, and just couldn't score. And I talked to the general manager about coming, and the coach at the time said, it's tough just to not be a full time or whatever, and so whatever. And they end up firing Terry Murray at Christmas time, and I knew who they were going to hire was Darryl. And like I said, I played for Darryl twice. I actually, the year I retired in San Jose, I finished the season coaching with him. So I just reached out to him, and I just said, look, your power play sucks. I just want to come and help. He said, absolutely. So I flew there January 3rd. They had a homestand. They had like 9 games or something. And so I helped with the power play. He just called me his a consultant to the head coach, whatever. We the 9 games, and then we went on the road. And I said, what do you want me to do? He said, well, I haven't been on the road team yet. I want you to come and roll with us. Great. Go on the road. We go Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver. We win, and we tie. So we go home. I say, what do you want me to do? I want you to stay. So I went, okay, great. So I end up staying the year and, helping with the kids. I hung with the players more than I did with the coaches, right? Darryl can be hard on the coach or the players at times, but I was always good, and I felt closer to the players because I still feel I'm still a player, right, at heart. So I got to hang with them. I got to stay for the year, and it was a lot of fun. I say to people, obviously, that win as a player, it was a lot of fun. I say I just can't imagine what it'd be like to win it as a player, because it was extra special as a coach too.
I can't imagine. Like, I love the way this starts, Bernie. You basically call, granted you had a relationship with him, but you're like, listen, your power play sucks and I'm going to be able to help you fix it.
Yeah.
Like, how did you know? What were you seeing and what did you implement?
Well, just as a skilled player, right? A lot of times you can have skilled players out there with no direction, really, right? So just to kind of give them a little bit of direction, and they had some talented players, Anze Kopitar, right? Like at the trade deadline, they traded for Jeff Carter too, which probably was as good a trade as they could make. But just, and you relate really well to the players, right? Skilled players, I think, were Daryl was not so much a skilled player. Like, I know we had him in Chicago, and that was one of the reasons I asked him. We had Jeremy Roenick, Tony Amonte, Joe Murphy, Gary Suter, Chris Chelios, myself. And that was our power play. And Daryl actually called us in, and he basically said, "Look, I don't play the power play. This is your power play. You guys just go do what you want with it. Just work hard at it." He left it up to us, right? I think we were 24% that year. We were the best in the league, really good. So I knew when I called him, I knew what his answer was going to be, because he'd already told me, "I don't run a power play," right? And obviously, who's ever the assistant coach that was running it at the time wasn't doing a very good job, because they sucked at it, right? So I kind of knew going in what he was going to say. So and easy, right? To go and I think it's easier for a skilled player to listen to another skilled player than listening to a coach that maybe isn't as skilled as you were. So it just made it easy to talk to the guys and just throw some suggestions at them. And it worked out great.
Did you kind of let them freewheel the same way Sutter let you guys freewheel in Chicago?
Yeah, pretty much. Once you give them some direction, right? And I think it makes it easier. Just because it's always the skilled players, right? You got to let skilled players use their skill. Don't kind of handicap them or put them in a position where they won't succeed. And I think when you do that, you kind of give them a little direction, and then that just makes it easy for them to use their own skill and kind of work it from there.
It sounds like we need you at Hockey Canada here, Bernie. It's a bit of a tangent, I'll admit, but every year this tournament comes along at Christmas, and I feel like we spend way too much time trying to build a team as opposed to just getting the best damn players we can and telling them to go out there and be good at their jobs.
Well, and that's kind of what it is, right? Like, you always see, have you ever seen a great coach that didn't have a great team? Like, and trust me, no disrespect to Glenn Sather, in the 80s, right? Like, it's not too hard to say, "Hey, Gretch, you're up. Hey, Mess, you're up. Cough, you go." You know what I mean? Like, but you still have to know how to use them. That's where Glenn was so good. You got to know how to use it. And you're always taught, right? You live and die with your best players. You win and lose with your best players. Glenn would never yell and scream at his third and fourth line players. You're not winning with your third and fourth line players. You win and lose with your skilled players. So you just let them go and you let them play. Like, I remember, when Babcock was here with Matthews, I don't know what his ice time was getting, but you couldn't play him enough. These young kids, you couldn't play them enough. Chris Chelios, he wanted to play a whole game one time, and he probably could have, right? Let him go. Like, you live and you die with your best players, and that's what happened. I think that was what happened with Babcock, with Matthews. Didn't play him enough, and I don't know how you couldn't play that guy enough. You can't play Leon and Connor McDavid enough in Edmonton. Just play them all night. You win and lose with your best players, and that's the way it is.
Even as you began to help that Kings team in 2012 turn things around, they came into the playoffs eighth, and you have to play the President's Trophy winning Vancouver Canucks in the first round. Do you remember the mindset going into that, Bernie?
I do. Funny thing is, we're playing in San Jose, last game of the year, and Daryl asked the coaches, who would you like to play in the first round? And you got to remember, I've only been there for half the year, and so is Daryl. And if we lose against San Jose, we end up in eighth place, and we play Vancouver. If we win, we go to St. Louis. St. Louis had, like, the best home record. They only lost, you know, not many games at home, but really good. But I said to Daryl, not that you ever want to lose, but I said I would sooner play Vancouver because just think you got a better chance against them, right? But it was like everything just came together. Like I said, they made that trade at the deadline. They got Jeff Carter. Mike Richards and him played together. That Kopitar, like, but it was all goaltending, right? Like, Jonathan Quick, he was the best player by far. They end up winning, I think 10 road games. They set a record for road wins, right? We went into Vancouver, won both games there, and lost game 4 at home. But we go back to Vancouver, win game 5. Go into St. Louis, who had the best home record. We swept them in 4. You know, it's like going to the second best team or something, Arizona, beat them 3 games in their building. But Jonathan Quick was, he gelled at the right time. He was unbelievable. He was by far, well, he won the Conn Smythe. So he was their best player. The team just played so well.
What did you do on your day with the cup?
Wow. Brought it home to the house. My mom and dad got to see it. I took it to our hunting camp. I actually had it out in a boat. My dad made a canoe for me. I made all of the boys a canoe. I had it out in the canoe. I had it up in a deer stand with my bow. I took it to the school. I took it to the arena. And a couple local stores around home, but I had everybody up. It was everything you could imagine it would be. Day with the cup's pretty special.
That's a full day for the cup.
Oh yeah, that thing. I wish the cup could write a book. Some of the places it's been helicoptered up on the top of a mountain. I think that's what Willie Mitchell had it done, or it might have been the two boys, Scotty Niedermeyer and his brother, headed up there too. Like, that thing's been everywhere. But it's a pretty special day.
You know, I'm just thinking, Bernie, about those experiences. And I know you're back in the Halliburtons now, and there's like the cup in your deer blind with you. I mean, you're a small town guy. LA must have been a culture shock beyond belief for you.
Yeah, and I've said this to different times to people, right? Like, when I first got drafted, because when you come from a little small town like that, you get hockey night in Canada every Saturday night, right? And you'd see that. I came home, and my mom came out. You just get drafted by the LA Kings. And I said, the LA Kings? I didn't even know they had a team, right? And then I go from my hometown at the time, and I get drafted, there's 75 people in my hometown. Like, where I went to school and where I played minor hockey, I had to travel like 15 miles to Halliburton. But my little town, there's 75 people. I go from the smallest town in the world to 10 million people in LA, right? You're flying in, and I'm used to playing hockey outside, the frozen ponds, the snow. And I'm flying in, and there's palm trees and 70 degrees in the wintertime. But I always say, right, and people see that now, after a game when it's 70 degrees, rather than when I was in Edmonton, it's minus 40. There's a big difference. There's a little bit more to do in Southern California in the wintertime than there is in Edmonton or back east here, you know. So that warm weather, a lot of athletes like the warm weather now. If they can get there, they don't mind it.
I could certainly understand that and appreciate it. That small town of yours made you its Citizen of the Year back in 2019. That's not a bad honor either, Mr. Nichols.
No, well, I always say without getting emotional, if I my mom and dad were also Citizen of the Year too, so I say if I ever do anything that, you know, they honor me the same as my mom and dad, then obviously I've done something good. So I was very proud of that.
What did your parents mean to your hockey career?
Sorry?
What did your parents mean for you in your hockey career?
Well, I always said everything I've learned in life was from my dad. You know, my dad was a really good hockey player, but he was the best coach I ever had. And I say this, and I truly mean it. He was probably harder on me than anybody because he knew what I was capable of doing. You know, like, so when he was teaching me or coaching me, he'd be harder on me than the other kids because, like I said, he knew what he had, right? So, and very smart. I tell people, I remember 10 years old taking face-offs in our kitchen floor, him teaching me how valuable face-offs were. And I took more pride in that than anything I ever did playing hockey because he taught you that. So just everything. My mom was my biggest fan. You know, I always laugh. I bought them a satellite dish so they could see our games, but they didn't come on till 10:30 at night, right? But she never missed a game. She's up at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, watching me play every night. I think she would might have been happier when I moved back east, so she didn't have to spend half the nights up watching me play hockey. So, but that was all. That's, you know, big part of my life is obviously them.
Oh, that's a great story. You were a hell of a baseball player though too, and you were in pro, like you're playing National Hockey League in the winter and summer. You're winning fast pitch tournaments back home.
Well, I went to the summer games for Canada in 1981. I played for Ontario. We won the All-Ontario fastball and got to play in the summer games with that. I love playing fastball. I played it my whole life. I three or four different teams I'd play for in the summertime. Like it was, I liked it every bit as much as hockey. I guess I was just a little better at one than the other.
Yeah, I think the hockey worked out okay for you, but that's not bad either. It
Worked out all right.
did.
Yeah.
From Floodlights to Bright Lights, your autobiography, what made you decide to write the book?
Oh, I had a couple people say I should. So, you know, and it was fun too, right? Just the journey where you go from, you know, from that small town to the big city and just the, you know, your story, I think, made a fun read. So I enjoyed writing it or, you know, being a part of it. I think the guy did a great job writing it. So it was a lot of fun to do, and just to have people read it and appreciate it. I've got a lot of compliments in it, so that makes it worthwhile too.
You know, we've talked about so many players, including some modern day players like Austin Matthews and all the skill and Shane Wright, who broke your rookie scoring record, et cetera. But those points that you were putting up and the era that you played the game, Bernie, which was certainly much more of a wide open style, offensive style of hockey. Do you miss that? Do you think we'll ever get back to anything even close the way it's played and coached today?
Yeah, I don't think so. Honestly, I think the game's better today as far as, you know, the kids are, they're bigger, stronger, faster. I think the goalies are much bigger and a little better athletes than they were back in the day too. I think they make it easier, for people to score goals, even though it's tougher too. Like, you can't clutch and grab. You can't put your stick on the other guy's stick. You can't, there's more power plays. There's more 5-on-3s. There's more 4-on-3s. There's just, I just think they make it easier for the skilled players. You watch guys today, they're skating around. They might as well skate around in sweats because you can't touch them. You can't put your hand on them. You can't in front of the net. Like, you would take an absolute beating in front of the net. I wouldn't go in front of the net back in the day because you're just going to get the hell beat out of you. Nowadays, you can go sit there. All the defensemen try to do is they try to box you out. They try to get in front of you. So I just think they make it easier to score, even though it is tough to score nowadays.
There was a label that followed you around mostly early in the career, but I'm really curious about it today. Were you a hot dog, Bernie Nichols? Are you one today?
I think I was very confident, but I think what it was, and I think I proved it earlier when we talked. I had fun, right? I was talking to players. I was always tapping goalies, talking to goalies, talking to players because I loved it. I had so much fun, right? Like, I'm laughing out there. And I think when I said to you earlier, I went right in the dressing room with the Islanders and got their autographs because I was just a kid. And that's how I played. I played because I had fun. I was a kid at heart and I just enjoyed it. And I think I think I got a bad rap that I wasn't serious or I wasn't, maybe dedicated enough or I was just cocky or arrogant. I was probably cocky for sure, because I was cocky with my ability. I knew I was good, right? But I think it was just people see me out there laughing, having fun, and maybe they just didn't think I took it serious. But when I told you earlier, going in and getting their autographs, I think that just shows what kind of a person I was as far as still a kid at heart playing a game. I just had fun playing, and maybe people took it the wrong way.
You wouldn't have tapped Billy Smith on the pads or talked to him, would you have?
Ooh, no, not Billy. Billy would take you over the head with his stick. But, Gramps, most of the goalies, I had a great relationship with them. If they made a good save, I'd tap them and congratulate them, And some guys, Billy wouldn't like it, but most of the other guys didn't mind it.
I think it's one of the things that the game does miss these days, isn't it, Bernie? A little bit of character.
Well, you know what? And, I know Alex Ovechkin took a beating in the press about, when he'd celebrate his goals and stuff. And I'm going, are you kidding me? You know how hard it is to score a goal in the NHL? Like, I get upset when people don't get excited when they score, right? Like Alex did, but he's only scored like 800 and some goals. But you can still see people still love to score. And I was no different. I love seeing that. And I just to see a guy not celebrate a goal, I don't get it. But you don't get that very often anymore. People, they enjoy scoring goals, and I was one of them.
Yeah, you had the pumpernickel.
That's right. Bob
Yeah.
Miller, he named that, and that was why I scored. I celebrated, and Bob nicknamed me at the pumpernickel, so it stuck. I
Are
wish I did it more.
you still having fun today?
I still love skating. I just did a Easter Seals event in Collingwood and went out, and we had two games on Friday. When I put my skates on, I still love it. I still feel like I'm a kid. It's and I don't think that'll ever, when it does change, then I won't play. But until that, I still do Mary Lemieux's fantasy camp. I did Gretz's until he stopped. I still do a lot of charity hockey games and still love putting my skates on.
You know, Bernie, I got to let you go, I know, but this just made me think of this. We're not far removed from the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Who do we have to talk to get Bernie Nichols in there?
I say it, and I honestly think it's where I played. Because, like I said, other than my mom staying up at 10:30 and midnight to watch me play, because most of the people who voted back in the day were from the East Coast and probably didn't watch a lot of games. And my comparison, right? And I mean this, and it's not a knock on the person, because there isn't a person in my opinion in the Hall of Fame that should not be in the Hall of Fame. There's not one. People said about Eric Lindros, never won anything, he shouldn't been there. Hell, he should have been in there. He was a beast when he played. Like, he was huge and played so, like, and his statistics aren't even close to mine. But the person I bring up all the time is Daryl Sittler. I say to people, if Daryl Sittler played in LA for his career, would he be in the Hall of Fame? And if you go yes, then I go no, because I played there, and my statistic, other than the 10 points, everything else is better than Daryl's, and I'm not in the Hall of Fame. So no, he wouldn't have. The Sedin twins, or Daniel Alverson. Daniel played in Ottawa. His statistics aren't even close to mine, but he's in. The Sedin twins, they played like 11 or 1,200 games and have 1,100 points. I played in 1,100 games and had 1,200 points. Not even theirs aren't even as close to mine, but they're in because they played in Vancouver, right? They played a couple, either the Olympics or World Championships. And I tell people, well, they never had Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, Dale Hawerchuk, Stevie Yzerman, Doug Gilmour, Brian Trottier, Newland as a centerman. That's who I had to beat out to play center, because I played center. All those guys are all centermen, so I'm not taking their job, right? So that's why I didn't play in the Olympics or World Championships, because I'm not better than those guys. But so that's what I tell people. So if it happens, it happens. But I think it's because of where I played.
Well, we're certainly glad that you did play and give us all the enjoyment over all the years. Congratulations again on the jersey retirement in Kingston. It's going to be great. We get up there early in the new year, so I'll get a chance to see it. And this has been a lot of
Perfect.
fun to sit down with you. Thank you very much for making the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Arianna Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.